certainly all of marketing is complex. I mean, you cannot change any part of marketing without affecting all other parts of your marketing.
When a company is struggling to succeed beyond their initial success, maybe that's because it is that element of luck that is irreproducible.
We can never know is what choices our minds made on our behalf without our knowing.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back again to Marketing Podcast 2025 edition. So we are back on with Doug Garnett. How are you doing, Doug?
I'm doing well. 2025, really?
We're recording on February 19th right now. So, you know,
so
if you waited just another couple of weeks.
Apologies for our brief hiatus, but we're back. So,
yeah. All right. So let's, without further ado, let's do our cartoon of the week.
First one of the year. Here we go. Well, we're going to go back to the Marketoonist, right? We, you know, you always love the Marketoonist, so you can find him at Marketoonist on Twitter. And it's got two people talking, a woman in a kind of a colorful shirt with a laptop in front of her and a rather dour-looking guy sitting across from her. She says, without a brief, I have no idea what you want. And the guy says, well, just be creative. And she says, can you share any specific direction? And his specific direction is, your deadline is yesterday.
Of course, yes. All right. So what immediately came to my mind was this experience I had many years ago when one of the folks who was requesting something specifically asked the person, it wasn't me, somebody else, please go ahead and be creative. I really want to explore the possibilities. So kind of provided a license for this person to go be creative. And then when it was all said and done a few weeks later, none of what he did was liked. So he was unhappy because he thought he was not appreciated or none of his creativity really worked. And the other person wasn't, because as much as they wanted creativity, clearly they didn't want it that way. Or if you ask somebody to go be creative, you're giving them a license to go do what they like, and you better talk up front about what it is that you might like.
Well, and I will say, as a vendor on the agency side, I was always suspicious when somebody would say, go be creative. You know, if they said, we trust you, we think you really understand this better than us, then I'd be, okay, that I agree, that I get. But if they just, you know, well, we don't really care, the answer is, oh, yeah, you do.
Yeah.
That was the general rule of thumb I developed. Just, you know, it's kind of like somebody who says, oh, well, you know, we're small, therefore we want to do it wisely. Also always meant they were going to muck around in details and cause you to spend far more than you had, because the small clients are afraid of losing their budget. So just so the people who are like, oh, just be creative, what they really is going on, they have a very specific idea usually in the back of their mind, and they just set you up to come back and they destroy your hopes and dreams.
Yeah, yeah.
I responded to the your deadline is yesterday.
Part,
because first of all, it pesters creative projects. And in fact, it is that the contradiction of go be creative, but your deadline is yesterday, which there is a truth that sometimes approaching a deadline kicks certain kinds of creativity into gear. And some really interesting things often happen right before something is due. On the other hand, telling somebody to be creative and not giving them time to be creative is just the worst thing. And companies do it all the time. I found so many clients that would do that and just expect, well, we want you to do what's really right, and I need it tomorrow. You know, to which you say, no, wait a minute. Do you want it really right, or do you want it tomorrow? Because you don't get both of those. And we haven't even talked about cost, because that's the third leg of it. But
Actually, you know, my observation is that different people fall on different parts of that spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
There are folks who really aren't, they're not set up to do anything slow. They really want to do it fast. And there are those who really won't do anything fast. They want to think about it. They want to get in the mood. So if depending on what project you need to also find somebody who's aligned with that kind of working.
Well, and in our work, we worked pretty interactively. And that was uncomfortable for some writers and art directors because, you know, it was just how we worked. I'm not going to claim that this was God's gift to the creative process, but it worked well in my company. Mm. And I found a lot of people who weren't able to deal with that. That idea of working collaborative was just really hard for them. And so I think one of the early projects, we paid him a bunch of money for a script project. And they went away and spent so much time on it that it was basically they spent the whole budget and then threw it over the wall and said, here's your script. And I read it through and went, no, this sucks. This is not our script, you know. And I don't mean sucks like the words are bad. Sucks like it's not going to achieve anything. And this is all about achieving something for the client. Beautiful words, well-written script, you know, flows, all that stuff, but it's not going to work. And therefore, but the budget had been spent by that point in time because of how they work. So there's a lot of different ways that people work. On the other hand, your deadline is yesterday is never never good. So
no, that's right. That's right. Okay, now that we feel creative, what's our main topic to start with?
You know, if we're creatives, we need to start with coffee. You know, I mean, that's how creative days start. Although I suppose these days it starts with kombucha sometimes and other things, matcha, other things. But we'll start with coffee because you and I are out of the coffee generation. And return to Starbucks, whom we've been discussing over a period of time. So when we last met, a new CEO had just joined Starbucks. So he's now been there for a quarter. We get to check in and find out how things are going. And I don't know whether we should start with the headlines or with the general reaction to it, because the headline is, well, let's just say the headline is not exactly affirming, because the truth is their store comps continue to go down. They were down 8% in transactions, but their transaction sizes aren't decreasing or are not doing too bad. So they're up 4% on the average transaction. And so Starbucks still has some serious challenges. But the reason that's not so bad is they beat Wall Street expectations. So I like processes like these because things don't change on a deadline yesterday, even if investors want it. And changing a behemoth like Starbucks is not something that's ever going to happen in one quarter. And so it appears, from my point of view, that they made progress and that investors are happy.
My recollection is that we were both pretty positive on the new CEO.
Yeah.
His record, his background, et cetera. And also some of the early decisions that he was making and that open letter that he had to everybody had a lot of good thoughts in it. And so it seems like that momentum has continued and he's made some decisions that are looking to be helpful.
My sense at this point in time, and this is for all of us in marketing, is he has taken a back to the basics approach. I'll call it that. You know, they call it back to Starbucks. So that's fundamentally back to basics.
That's good brand.
A lot of that has been in the stores, working on ways to support the people in the stores, the baristas, you know, all these kind of places where they have had serious challenges over the last few years. And so there's a lot about that that always seemed right. So it appears this is kind of what I would expect. If that's working, I wouldn't expect instant results, but you'd want to see things begin to solidify. So in a way, he's been out there putting his finger in the dike to hold back the floods. And it seems to have worked. And I think that's really good. And that's really encouraging. It also is particularly encouraging for me about him, because so many CEOs feel like they have to run around making big pronouncements and massive choices. And my one fear out of his background is that he'd been pretty involved with techifying Chipotle. Right. And I was a little worried that he might believe there was some magic shiny tech bauble that Starbucks was missing. And everything I see here indicates that he's much more practical than that. And that's good. I like that. I think that makes that's what they need.
Digital offerings and competing with the folks who show up and he was taking steps to fix those.
I'll believe more firmly in it when they get rid of some of their metrics. I've learned since we last talked about Starbucks that there's actually a metric for that everybody who works there is measured on how they greet clients. So the person at the drive-thru has to say something personal to the customer.
Wow.
And they have some sort of metric. I mean, I don't know how they work it. I never found out what kind of spy cams or if it's just observations of people. But first of all, that's a really silly idea. And secondly, I hate it because when I go through the drive-through, I've been to the same Starbucks for 20 years. I do not need a personal comment. Well, are you doing anything fun this weekend? That seems to be the usual one. The answer is, pardon me, but oh, fuck off. I'm just doing my thing. You know, I just want some coffee. Can you give it to me? And so,
not your business.
Yeah. Now, I haven't heard that he's eliminated that. But the second overt thing we can talk about that he's brought out is there is new advertising for Starbucks.
Right.
I've seen two ads. And one of them is called, That's Not My Name. And I really liked it because I've always said the most personal greeting at a Starbucks is when I go into the Starbucks I've gone to for years, and whoever's behind the counter says, hey, sup, how you doing, you know? Because that's personal. They get me. They understand me, you know, and they're personally greeting me. Whereas, checking the cup and saying, hello, Doug, how are you today? Is just, I mean, that just kills it all right there. So I think that the ads show a really lovely world at the Starbucks store. And if that's the world that he sees, that's good for Starbucks.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like both ads. There was also the Super Bowl ad of It Starts in Darkness, mm-hmm. and how they open up each store at the crack of dawn. And we all know that they really are there at like 5:30 in the morning. And then Not My Name, also nice. Both of them told me a lot about authenticity, that they're sort of owning the reality of mm-hmm. the store. Misspelled names, they're all been liked as a.
Yeah. So I'm pleased with that. And that seems, I think, in a way that fits with his back to Starbucks focus. So,
right.
So far, a lot of things that look nice. And I think maybe the best thing for Starbucks out of all this is their stock went from, call it 93 or 77. It's hard to tell when exactly this all came out, up to 112. So apparently the stock market is encouraged. And that's very good for Starbucks because the stock market hasn't been encouraged for them for quite a while.
Yeah. No, I like Starbucks. I'm glad that they're doing well.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I want to ask you mm-hmm. is that they also mentioned things like sustainable long-term growth, like, you know, growth strategy. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's also what Wall Street wants to hear, sort mm-hmm. of a forever growth within an area, and then you expand into other areas, et cetera. So that leads to two questions and a good segue. You know, one question is that, why does a company succeed? What mm-hmm. are the ingredients of success? And then the second one is really a segue into the book you're writing mm-hmm. on complexity. So we should check in with you and see where that stands.
Okay.
But all of this stuff, I mean, is there anything in marketing that doesn't, you know, smack of complexity yeah. or business strategy? So
no.
So it's like relevant to everything, but mm-hmm. definitely it's relevant to this. So
yeah, I mean, yeah, certainly all of marketing is complex. I mean, you cannot change any part of marketing without affecting all other parts of your marketing. You know, if you change your product, you have to revisit price, distribution, advertising. You know, it's a constant cycle, and that's essentially complexity at work. So, you know, just in a quick summary, the book, I've made some interesting progress, and I've got a publisher who is out reviewing it at this point in time on a kind of a 4 to 6 week review process. It doesn't mean they're going to publish it, but I'm hopeful. So it feels like a grand first step, and it also means that I've had to button it up for them. So there is a buttoned up version of the book, and I'm trying to be careful and not modify it too much past where it was buttoned up. And in fact, what I'm looking forward to is feedback on what seems to work within it, what doesn't, what are people's responses. I'm hoping to get some feedback from all this to hear, because I think, you know, the more I've worked with it, the more I've written about it, the more I talk with people, I think there's just this incredible need for those of us in business to begin to really understand the true complexity of what we're trying to do. And that so much of business writing ignores that. Much of business writing tries to provide simple two-step solutions or five-step solutions or, God help us, 61-step solutions, because I've seen books that claim that, and that they don't exist and that don't lead to success. So, back on your other question, the question is, what is success here? I think it's really difficult that the market expects companies to always grow. And it leads to some incredible dysfunctions that hurt shareholders in the long run. You know, for example, there's lots of companies who buy growth, right? They can no longer create growth themselves. So they go out and buy companies in order to add that revenue on top of theirs. And then they create an appearance of growth, except they never did the growth themselves. So it's not like they learned from exploring that they, you know, created some innovation and that they, you know, became healthier as a result. They just simply look better and people reward their stock for it. So I actually am pretty, if you really turned me loose, I could get even darker about growth. But we'll take out the great Kenneth Boulding quote. Anyone who believes in indefinite growth in anything physical on a physically finite planet is either mad or an economist. So, you know, and I think actually there's a flip side to it, which is there are sets of companies who thrive over very long periods of time without serious growth. And I don't mean just annual inflation or, you know, little bits of up and down, but they really establish themselves and then thrive just generating profit, doing well, and continuing. And the people who run those companies say it's really weird to go to neighborhood parties where when people say, well, what are you doing in your business? You say, well, I'm doing pretty well and I'm just kind of, you know, maintaining size. They get these questioning looks like, are you insane? You know, your business, you're supposed to be growing. And I think there's some really serious issues around growth. Starbucks, well, Starbucks probably needs to get back to growth, and I think the market will demand it of them. But what concerns me is I think there's a natural reality of their market. And the question is, to what degree do they still have growth potential within the structure they have? And if they need other growth, they may have to go outside of stores and espresso and find even other brand, you know, create a separate brand under their ownerships to go pursue. And I don't know that expecting that, you know, espresso drink sales and the related stuff is enough to have them grow.
Right. So another question regarding complexity is that when I think about what it takes to grow, even in the beginning, not just sort of sustainable long-term, which I'm in agreement with you, nature just doesn't do that. Like, you know, you look at anything in nature, it grows and it grows really rapidly and then it plateaus.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right. From humans to animals to forests to whatnot, right? And even examples in industry are that they, you know, rapid growth invariably plateaus as you run out of something, whatever it was that was compelling that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but how do you even get that initial? So you could say that you have to be smart, you have to have the proper skills. I buy that, I get this. But I have to think that there's also some element of luck, some element of context.
There's a lot of that. And I think that's actually, you know, one of the things I'm most encouraged about is I've been writing a lot about essentially the paths of success, trying to comprehend them and moving away from the way we're taught within business schools to think of them, which is, well, you go do some sort of funky statistical analysis and you can declare that this company succeeded because of X or, you know, whatever that is. Because I think that, you know, the real truth is that when you look at it, companies succeed based on huge numbers of factors. We can begin to separate those into things like context and things like the motivating events. Let's call it that, motivating events. So you might, if you're looking at Apple Computer and you're looking in the 1980s, you might say that a piece of context is that people were dissatisfied with mini computer data centers and wanted their own computers. Okay, so that's a latent thing. Did that create Apple? No, it didn't. You know, it wasn't the thing that created them. And then you've got Steve Jobs, and he, you know, does his brilliance. Okay, he does his brilliance. But here's the thing. His brilliance wouldn't have turned into anything big if there hadn't been that latent demand. And so without the context, which was people wanting to get away from those mini computer data centers, Apple would not have become what it became. That doesn't mean that that was the cause. And so you start looking and you start realizing there's all these interrelated factors and they're not impossible to understand. You know, you can actually look at it and kind of come to a comprehension of, oh, this is the stuff that uniquely came together in 1980 when Apple went public that led to the company that eventually evolved into, you know, Apple Inc. today. But when you do that, you have to be ready for a more interwoven or complex narrative about it. You know, well, there was this thing, there was that thing, and then this worked well. I mean, for example, Sequoia Capital was involved very early. And I've read that whoever Jobs worked with most at Sequoia was really the mentor who taught him how to market. And so everybody thinks that Steve Jobs somehow grew up magically as a marketing genius. That doesn't happen. You know, he was 25 at the time. He's about to appear on the cover of Time magazine. How do you prepare for that? Well, they had wise people that were helping them get there. And if you look at success, then you can't just say, well, it was Steve Jobs. You have to say, yeah, Jobs was critical within it, but you've got a lot of other factors, and you need to figure out how to kind of understand those. Once you do that, then the issue of luck comes up. You know, the fact that all those came together at the same time is why Apple took off so big. Mm-hmm. You know, now, can you recreate that situation? I don't know exactly about recreate. What I might suggest is, can you look around yourself if you're starting a business and figure out which factors you can start to leverage in order to create something good? And then to some degree, you have to trust. If you're lucky, it'll become massive. If you're less lucky, it just becomes big. And if you're unlucky, it fails. But
Yeah. And it's hard to come up with any advice that always works, let alone business advice. But I do give him credit for being mentorable, right?
Oh yeah, that's a pretty impressive thing, given how cocky we tend to think of Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
You know, for him to have been able to be mentored on marketing, you know, what a difference. And maybe, you know, the truth is he may have had an instinct that said, whoa, this is really important.
Right.
And responded as a result. But I think these are these issues of complexity, because complexity is all about these interactions and adaptations, right? Adaptation. So as things interact, they naturally adapt. So as Sequoia Capital worked with Jobs, Jobs adapted through those interactions he had with Sequoia. At the same time, Sequoia adapted through its interactions with Steve Jobs. And now we throw Wozniak into that. Oops, now you got three people and they're all kind of interacting and adapting with each other. And that's what creates these kind of feedback loops that can cause really tremendous success. If that is all happening in good, useful, positive ways, then the company can just rocket.
Right. So then I was thinking along these lines that when a company is struggling to succeed beyond their initial success, maybe that's because it is that element of luck that is irreproducible, that maybe they have everything else. Mm-hmm. They are smart, they are skillful, and they're trying to apply the same thing that they did before, and it's not working. My God, why is it not working?
Right.
Because that time I got lucky, this time I'm not, because, well, that one is not predictable, repeatable. So is that... Could that be it?
Well, I wouldn't say that's it, but I think that is a reality. I think it's more serious of an issue if a company, what I see is companies who reach a first success tend to believe too much in their first success. You know, companies tend to believe, well, we got here because we were smart, instead of we got here, that's pretty cool. Let's keep the doors open for something else to happen. You know, amid complexity, I talk about you need to keep the door slightly ajar so that good things can come in. And a lot of companies, though, once they get to success, they batten down the hatches, right? They try to, you know, they're so fearful that success might not last or that they might lose part of it, that they batten down the hatches and stop really perceiving how the market is moving. Because if I look at Apple in 1980, in fact, I did a chart this morning, which is, okay, here's Apple in 1980. Well, if you want to understand interactions, you have to do a different chart for 1997 when Steve Jobs came back. You have to do a different chart for 1985 when Steve Jobs was kicked out. And you have to do another one for 2007 when the iPhone came out. Because each of those is going to look very different because everything everywhere is changing all at once in a sense. And so companies batten down the hatches. That's it. We've got success. We're successful forever. And then they get confused by the fact that they're not running into bits of luck, but they close the door to keep all the luck out. In a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's not that you, no matter what you do, you can run out of luck and that happens. And, you know, that's why business law is set up to handle the fact that happens.
But there are some general rules that are always valid. I mean, they're hard to interpret, perhaps, mm-hmm. but for example, being in touch with reality is always a good thing.
Yeah. Well, I right? think, yeah, being able to observe reality and comprehend reality is critical. And a lot
separate
of people
your ego that. From it. And yeah.
Yeah. Separate your ego. Don't believe your own stories. I think one of the big, I've got a portion of the book where I talk about executive, what we don't understand and ever honor amongst executives is that we are more likely to have a bias than the people that work for us. And it makes sense because we've got a lot of skin on the game in the game on That's believing right. that we did the right thing. But that makes us more susceptible to bias. Whereas the the hubris of an executive is always, well, I know how to detect biases. But those people that work for me, phew, boy, you got to watch out for bias with them. And actually, the flip side is kind of true. The other thing, another bit of hubris is that I think we're never advised that our minds make choices without us. So an executive.
Say more.
Well, okay. So here's what happens. I'll give you my example. I wanted to buy a Tahoe in 2001, a 2001 Tahoe. Friend of mine mm-hmm. is out on the auction market. So he says, hey, I'll have my guys pick one up for you when we see a good
This
one.
Is a car, right?
A car, yeah. Sorry, a Tahoe yeah, SUV. Yeah. And yeah. Family road trip vehicle, all that stuff.
Right.
So he goes out and he starts looking. He calls me up one day, says, whoa, we got one that's just rocking. It's loaded. It's in great shape. It's relatively low miles. There's only one thing. I said, oh, what's that? Now, I had asked for like a taupe or a brown or something like that. He says, well, this one's white. And I thought to myself for a minute, I thought, white? I haven't seen many white Tahoes. Sure, no problem. And so I said, we'll buy it. And he went off to get it. And I hopped in my car to drive the mile to Starbucks and saw 10 white Tahoes on the way. Now, what happened in that, right? This is where it's worth thinking about. What
you
happened?
Started paying attention.
Well, yeah, white Tahoe didn't mean anything to me. So the only ones I was paying attention to were the taupe and gray color. And every time I saw one of those, it got logged in my mind. My mind paid attention, cataloged it, put it in my mind. White, it just ignored them because my mind had too much to do. Our minds can't pay attention to everything. Then all of a sudden, a white Tahoe's interesting to me. And two things happen. One is my mind starts noticing them. So the minute I change my focus and see it as important, I remember it. Now, what an executive basically we can never know is what choices our minds made on our behalf without our knowing it.
Right.
Right. Our mind is making these choices of what to see or not to see without our knowing it. And therefore, when an executive says, well, I've observed everything, well, have you? A certain amount of humility is needed for that.
Yeah.
The other thing that happened is the Bader-Meinhof effect, which is called the frequency effect, which is when you see something new, you tend to exaggerate how often you see it. So I think the reality is I probably saw 2 or 3 white Tahoes. But in my mind, I'm like, that's 5 or 10. They're everywhere because my mind exaggerated, which there I just think of how many executives come bombing in and saying, wait, we just detected this customer service problem. It's everywhere. And you think, really? Is it really everywhere? Or is that just because it's new to you? And I don't mean to be picking on executives. I just think I kind of talk about it because I think we have this prejudice within business that says once you rise above these kind of simple mistakes. And the truth is we don't. They're always a potential. Right. It's always a potential for me to not see something because it wasn't important to me in that, situation.
Well, that's an excellent prelude into another discussion because the unemotional manner with which we need to look at all the data is clearly something that AI will do well. And we were discussing AI and ChatGPT and its emergence, and one of the topics that came up was the impact of AI on search and search engines. And especially because so many dollars go towards digital ads and Google has the lion's share of that market with all manner of systems and software and et cetera, et cetera. So what about AI versus search?
Well, actually,
at what point will AI replace search, let's say?
First of all, can I come back briefly to the unemotional part of AI, which is I suppose the AI itself is unemotional, but our emotions just might change the questions we ask it. And,
that's true, the
human interface to it can really shift what comes back.
Also, AI could embed our emotional bias without us knowing. Because,
Okay, so and this one surprised me a bit, because I think, you know, as I've looked around, and I try to have a distant view on some of these things, even though I study, you know, I've listened to a lot of stuff about AI, but at a distance, it's felt like AI was all about automated customer service reps, all about automated things writing for us, all about automated things creating video, you know, creative service stuff, or analyzing factories or things like that. Then it pops up on the radar that, in fact, there's a hidden thing about AI that as soon as ChatGPT came out, there are a fair number of people who've started using that for search. And the reality is AI can be a relatively good search engine and, you know, detect things. And in fact, I watch the Google search that comes up at the top of the list when it pops up, and it's fairly good. You know, I haven't ever seen anything I'd say, well, that's bullshit. I tend to ignore it just because I'm a bit of a curmudgeon and like to read it for myself. But on the other hand, the summaries seem to be quite good. And so that leads us to this odd, hidden long-term potential that people could shift to searching through AI. If they find that it's more effective and faster and more straightforward, or gives them more depth, or gives them some kind of advantage. And if I was Google, I'd be pretty worried by that.
Right. So I believe they already are very worried. And in fact, that's why they are doing this AI-generated summary on the search strings that you put in that resemble a prompt. Right. And if you actually put in like a question, then they do a, you know, free summary up front, and that can in fact be quite useful, and it's quite nice. And that allows them to retain all the search, the traditional search below, and retain all the sponsored links and Google ads and display ads and all text ads that they do. And I think if you're a marketing guy, now you have to wonder, at what point do I need to make my go-to-market demand gen portfolio have that in mind? You also want to make sure that your content marketing is searchable by AI. Like, what sort of SEO, quote unquote SEO, are you doing? It's not really search engine optimization. It's AI chatbot optimization.
Well, yeah, because the question, how do you optimize what you put out for it to work within that? So if we just want to go with organic, you know, then what we put out has to somehow feed into the search engine, the AI engines, in order for us to be discovered. And
That's right. And I really recommend all the marketing folks listening to go pursue that, because there are already best practices emerging on how to do that. Obviously, content creation, et cetera, is a separate matter, and ChatGPT AI can help there and its variants. But I don't think that's happening yet. I feel like, to the extent that search and AI are colliding, that's still in its early days. I don't see a uniform pattern of usage in terms of how people search. There are folks who are still kind of stepwise go through AI, and there are those who've accelerated to, I'm just going to ask my ultimate question, right? Instead of piecemealing it in my head and then consolidating it myself, I'm just going to cut to the chase and say, this is what I'm trying to do. What do you recommend, right? Well, and that's kind of interesting.
And in fact, you know, what that does, I mean, for Google, that might eliminate three or four mid steps. So if you can ask your ultimate question instead of, you know, I mean, I find that in order to search effectively, you have to game the search engine to some degree and think.
That's right.
What are the keywords that might get me to something useful? And that's not obvious to begin with.
Right.
And so we have to game it. So, okay, if we can ask our final question, and we don't necessarily have to do that.
Yeah.
And I think, but the other part of me starts thinking about paid search and AdWords and those kinds of things that so many companies spend a lot of effort on and a lot of money on. And if, you know, are those going to lump over into AI search on Google? I'm sure Google's running around like crazy trying to figure this out. I doubt if they know the answer, but they're probably really working hard trying to figure out how are they going to deal with this, because they need that revenue.
Likewise with AI providers, if you're ever going to have ad revenue, how are you going to provide it? In fact, if I ask a question and your question recommends a product or a service, to what extent is that not an embedded ad that somehow the content, I mean, this is why you do want to do you know, SEO, so to say, mm-hmm. for your content for AI, mm-hmm. because then AI will incorporate it into its response and you come across as a recommendation mm-hmm. rather than an ad, if you manage to do that, right?
Oh my God, I'm getting more headaches from this, Shaheen. Yeah, because I think, you know, the reality, I mean, one of the things that frustrates me is if you take today a medical question and you ask it in Google, I find it very difficult to sort through the wheat from the chaff. You know, there are a few websites that are relatively reliable on that stuff, and then you get hundreds that are somebody either wanting your business or somebody with their own RFK theory.
Well, you kind of have so-called influencers who have said something about it and they show up, right? So you have to be able to filter that. Mm-hmm. With AI, it becomes part of a bigger narrative and it becomes harder to filter that. But what I see right now is that A, there are no patterns of usage. And then B, it doesn't always understand your prompt. When it does or when it doesn't, it also hallucinates. So you have mm-hmm. to be worried about that. And then thirdly, it doesn't always give you what you want. Like we talked about it the other day that, you know, I go and search something and I just get the answer, whereas the AI just turns it into a white paper. I'm not going to read a white paper. I don't want a 3 paragraphs. I want it just as pithy as you can make it. Yeah. Can you? Uh-huh. And I don't want to have to tell you to do that.
Right.
So uh-huh. sometimes it just doesn't give you what you want. So uh-huh. early days, but man, I think it's coming.
I think that's interesting because I continue to look around at AI. I'm still struggling to find places that I really think it's going to be highly successful for the mass market. Specialized stuff, I got no question there's going to be stuff out there, but kind of the mass market level, I'm just, you know, I can think of no worse customer interaction experience than those I've had with AI bots, you know, and they're classic because they always go down a certain path, you know. Hi, I'm Bob the bot, here to help you. And what's your question? And I ask it my question. It says, yeah. I can't answer that. Let me get you a representative. I'm like, could we have just started there? You know, if you can't answer it, what the hell are you doing over there? But,
So my view is that AI is just automation. Mm-hmm. And if you can define it, you can automate it. And mm-hmm. and over time, mm-hmm. you're going to be able to define more and more things, mm-hmm. and then you can automate more and more things. And it's already having an impact on content creation, whether it's your second draft or summary of what you received. And I mean, the joke is that you give it 4 bullets, it generates a white paper, you send it to me because you want to market to me, mm-hmm. I feed it to my AI and say, can you turn that into 4 bullets?
All right, so here's my last thought, is we're kind of running a little towards the end here, so I just wanted to say it might be worth mentioning the absolutely incredible, freaking outstanding growth at NVIDIA that relates to AI. For the listeners, Shaheen and I did a deep dive over the past few days, a lot of talking about NVIDIA. It's just enough to know that they went from, you know, let's call it kind of $6 billion to $36 billion over about a year and a half in quarterly sales. So, just rocking and rolling, and that is primarily a result of AI. And it's a hell of an impressive thing.
Well, we kind of both started and kind of grew up in the market that NVIDIA now commands. Mm-hmm. And as many of you know, they got their start in doing gaming mm-hmm. hardware, doing chips that were especially good at computer graphics. So mm-hmm. they did kind of visualization software, but also gaming at higher and higher frames per second with better accuracy. Mm-hmm. And then they parlayed that into data center and scientific engineering computation, and that prepared them to greet the AI opportunity mm-hmm. and ride it mm-hmm. and lead it quite well. And they have executed flawlessly. They're just really wonderful company from that standpoint. And it's not for the absence of competition. Their competition has been numerous and consistently failing. It is only in recent years that there's just so many companies competing with them that a few of them are starting to look like they could be worthy competitors. AMD is really the most notable. Intel actually is quite good in gaming and sort of struggling to kind of catch up with AI, but they do have some good technology there. And then there are like a raft of second tier providers that are not bad at all. They're doing something really interesting as well. So, but then the market is so huge mm-hmm. that all of them can grow and have a great time without really impacting NVIDIA's market share. So they've expanded into automotive recently. And then as of even more recently, into software, into cloud, and into other areas. And they just have a wonderful portfolio, and that has catapulted their revenue. as well as their valuation. So now they are like consistently one of the top five highly valued companies in the world.
And just on top of that, CEO Jensen Huang is a Oregon State University graduate. So, you know.
Yeah. And I tell you, as a tech celebrity, which they all are, he is really a masterclass on how to be a celebrity. Mm-hmm. He's comes across as humble. He shows a lot of humility. He works hard. He drives a hard charging, high quality, high performance team. He comes across as one of the guys. He shows up. He takes selfies with people. Mm-hmm. He shakes hands. He's just like, you know, really, really nice. Not. And of course, this guy is like, heads of states want to talk to him. Everybody wants a piece of NVIDIA. And that culture sort of shows up in the company as well. That really bodes well for them.
That's good.
And they execute like mad. They are very competitive, very, very good. So what can I tell you? They're king of the hill right now.
That's excellent.
So, and if in fact, if you look at their growth, we were talking about how sustainable long-term growth, they have kind of defied that because they have been pretty much growing like a power law. You know, they're growing like a, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk kind of a thing. Where is that going to end? Well, you know, you have to expand into adjacent markets to be able to keep growing. Apple has done that with phones, with iPads, with Apple Pay, with Apple TV, with music, right? So I expect that NVIDIA as well will keep expanding into adjacent markets. Good. So
here ends the first episode of 2025.
Is that right? Are we ready to conclude then?
Well, I think so. I think we should. Right. I think we could talk forever like we did for the past couple of days. And while you I would love it, I'm not sure everybody listening would perhaps find as much value from it.
That's right. That's right. Well, if anybody is out there, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
for listening. We are actually recording the video feed of this as well, both because it's nice to see each other as we talk. But if we can manage to turn that into a video, you will also be seeing it on YouTube. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Until next time. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Shaheen.
All right. Take care, everybody.
That's it for this episode of the Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.